pleasure to be here, and I thank you folks for all for coming. What I thought I would do, we're going to have a little panel presentation, and I'd sort of serve as a moderator, if you will. One of the objectives of this was to allow for us to explain how the Forest Service works and how we care for the land, your land, the people of the United States, and how we take care of the resources. And in order to do that, we thought we'd break it into four sections. Sonny O'Neill, the new forest supervisor here on the Wenatchee, is going to talk about the mission statement, caring for the land, serving the people, to be followed by Dick Buescher, who is going to talk a little bit about the history of how that evolved. And then Don Smith is going to pick it up and talk about some transition and some change, how the multiple use is moving about into an era of change. And then to wrap it up is Gary Heath. He's going to talk about our new forest land management planning process and how that's going to carry us on into the future. So each person will talk about 3 to 4 minutes, and hopefully we'll allow you to get some clarification on where we've been, where we are now, and where we're headed into the future. So with that, I'll turn it over to Sonny.
Okay, this afternoon we dedicated section of the Portal Museum up there that Holden Village has provided some space there, and we have a little display there, and the folks that put it together chose to use the Forest Service mission statement as part of that, which is caring for the land and serving people. I might tell you a little bit about how that came about. A little over a year ago, all the forest supervisors nationwide met, I guess for the first time that forest supervisors ever met together at one place. And we were looking for ways that we could have some information or kind of a goal statement that all of our employees could relate to, something that they could focus on for the future. And that meeting, plus some additional providing information and getting feedback with all of our employees nationwide, we came up with that mission statement, which is caring for the land and serving people. And really what that means is the national forests that we care for belong to the people of the United States. And we care for that land on behalf of all the citizens of the United States. And it's not Forest Service land. We don't care for it for Forest Service people's sake. It's all the people of the United States' sake that we care for, the land for. And then the serving people, by caring for that land, then that serves the people of the United States. So that's what we mean, and that's our focus for the future. Is caring for the land and serving people. And we hope that in 20 years that the people of the United States will perceive that the Forest Service as an agency does in fact care for the land and serve people.
Okay, thank you. Now Bush, if you'd like to pick that up and kind of give us a little background on where we started and how that what has been in practice.
You know, that's kind of an undoable job, the Forest Service history in 3 minutes. But they probably picked me to do this. I've got 30 years in, so maybe I'm the forest historian now. And you should know that off and on, 23 of those, or 24 of those 30 years, I've had an association with Holden Village. And it's been a happy one. Forest Service was born on June 4th, 1897, and I remember that date by the darndest coincidence. June 4th just happens to also be my birthday. And, not 1897.
he's 2 years older.
Yeah, it was actually 1894. But we were given birth by the Congress through the entreaties of Gifford Pinchot and Teddy Roosevelt and others, but those are two prominent figures in the effort because of the concern for abuse, primarily of western land, and abuse in terms of timber barrens and uncontrolled stock use and uncontrolled mining. And so it's important you understand that our original role was protection. And our image was built on protection and, of course, uncontrolled fires. And that's the most prominent image that we seem to have, is that we also protect the forest from fire, and we've got a bear with a shovel that helps us do that. And by the way, he doesn't use a shovel on the fire. He uses it on us if we don't do our job. And so we moved gradually in the 30s toward a new mission. And the Congress moved with us, and we had changing laws. Now I'll talk a little about the multiple use concept. We became a use agency, both through our own energies, through people's desires, who recognize their ownership of the forest, and through the leadership of some really remarkable people. A lot of folks don't understand that the wilderness system that we have today was given birth, for example, by Forest Service leadership, not by environmental communities and so on. The first wildernesses were established by the Forest Service without benefit of classification as administrative areas. And there are many famous Forest Service names: Alvin Leopold, Bob Marshall, Arthur Carhart, and so on, all who were movers of the wilderness movement. So we began to pick up another resource. And obviously we have a major timber mission. The national forests, unlike the national parks, and don't confuse the two, have entirely different missions. National forests, the largest public domain of public lands in a system, are multiple use lands, and timber is a very important part of that use. So are special use opportunities like Holden Village and mines like the one on the hill, and grazing, and many other things. We've moved now, even with later laws, into what is, interestingly to me, and a resource for which I'm responsible for in the region, one of the oldest resources on Earth and one of the newest, really, to our recognition, and that is the cultural resources. And we are talking about both prehistoric and historic. And there are thousands, literally thousands, of historic buildings on national forest land, and of course we're in one, that we manage. And we have hundreds of thousands of prehistoric sites. One of the things that made this trip so special for me was to see the success of the museum, and what Rudy's accomplished here with a lot of hard work from others is the sharing of one of the cultural resources that occurs on the National Forest, and that's the Holden Mine. Because we spend a great deal of money on inventory, we have not spent as much time and energy on the sharing of what we've learned. And so that's become a major part of our portfolio of responsibilities. When you think of the Forest Service use and its history, think of its development from an agency that first protected, got a hold of things that were undesirable, moved then to an emphasis on wise use and a blended use or multiple use, and then still the emergence now in very recent years of recognition of new resources. And there'll be more. There'll be more. People have become a major component of our recognition of what the National Forests are all about, and that's why our really strong current emphasis on serving people—that is our job—and we try to do that as well as we can. That's an awful short Forest Service history. I look forward to dialogue.
Don's going to pick it up now and about going through some change. Don, as I hope that everybody knows, Don has just recently retired as the forest supervisor here on the Wenatchee.
Thank you. It's only fair then that I can reminisce, and I only have one boss to report to now, and that's my wife, so a lot of license. I thought it would be appropriate to share a few highlights that I saw occur during this period since I came to the forest in 1980, which involves change and transition, which is also happening around the world in our country and to the Forest Service. And then pick up a few opportunities that I see now and on the immediate horizon for Holden and us and this partnership that we've had for this long period of time. Some of the highlights, and the first that comes to mind, is that we did survive a number of changes in leaderships in our various organizations. When I came to the forest, John and Wern were deeply entrenched here, and you successfully made a transition to Elmer and Kent, which is not easy. And I don't see Werner here, but Werner was invaluable to the knowing where and what went on here, and which knobs and clauses and permits and the whole thing. It's a tremendous knowledge store that was not really written down anywhere, unfortunately. We also went through three, four supervisors in the sense that John Rogers was the supervisor and left, and I came, and now Sonny's aboard, which probably will least affect the partnership, because in our outfit it's a very decentralized organization, unlike most all government agencies. And the key person is the ranger on the ground. And that's been Bob Hetzler, who spent 12 years here working with the organization, and that, which is about half the life of the Holden Corporation, and so key, because we rely, the agency and relies on that key contact, the ranger and his people, to solve about 90% of the problems. We are in support in the supervisor's office of the ranger, and Dick in the regional office is in support of us. We're very decentralized and don't have to call Washington, D.C. to make a decision on what's going on. And it's
We don't even know the number.
We always call them late in the afternoon and they've already gone. So there's been a key transition there with Bob going on to greater things and Al Murphy, and I know that we feel there won't even be a change in pace, though, because Al is coming in with the same dedication that Bob had left, and that's key. So we essentially survived the transition of things that could trip us up or cause us to delay in moving forward. And you know, the world just doesn't have the place for that. Another highlight, which is sort of a non-highlight, is that we had essentially no major disasters. When you live and work in the woods and the out of doors, as you know that are here, you're really not in control of anything. You just cope with what Mother Nature does. And except for the sewage problem, the drain field thing that just came in the latter part, we survived any major disasters. And that approached it last year when the Department of Health and things said, listen, if things aren't fixed up by such and such as of July or some date, you'll have to shut down. Well, think of that, folks. Think of that if we were to say, go home tomorrow because of that disaster. We achieved the construction and partnership with the Park Service and a whole host of agencies, the construction of Fields Point. And any of you visitors here that have come back in time, 3 years of the past, when you tried to park your car or whatever at 25 Mile Creek, it was a real zoo. And the beauty of Fields Point, not only that the facilities that have been constructed and those that are come, but it was part of some long-range planning, and Dick could elaborate that on that occurred way back in some of the history that he talked about, that Dick was involved in, the development of the North Cascades Park, and part of that dealt with improving the facilities, the transportation facilities on Lake Chelan, which was the development of Fields Point. So, you know, if you're patient with us, it'll eventually come. And Fields Point was really, really neat. And tied with that is a system that we traditionally, in our culture, want to do everything. We want our people with our uniforms and badges and Forest Service colors to manage things. And we, in the cutbacks of manpower and things, we've made changes and in fact put out a prospectus for a concessionaire. And Holden was a successful bidder. They met the compensation. And you folks are doing the job there of serving the public and helping us out, and it's just worked perfect, again, in a different, unique partnership. So anyway, Fields Point. The Washington Wilderness Bill passed, and you might say, well, how does that affect us? Well, it did, maybe in subtle ways. Everything south of Railroad Creek, down the road a piece, and then of course it cuts off, was placed in the wilderness. And that's sort of special land because that was some of the first Swiss cable system logging that occurred in this country, and it was logged, and many people don't even recognize that. There was special language in the Washington Wilderness Bill that allowed the entry of your water system to be in the wilderness, and so on. A disappointment during this period. The Lucerne proposal was rejected. We solicited proposals for development and facilities at Lucerne. We had several. Holden had an excellent one. We supported it on the forest, and one of the rare times when we were not successful for various reasons, it was not adopted. Lucerne area got cleaned up, which was part of a previous obligations. And I guess the good thing about it is it sits there available for some yet future use but it was a disappointment, and we shared that and shrugged it off. I can tell you a little story. I think I'll tell you a little one.
All right.
I won't tell the story.
You can tell the story after
okay,
we...
Okay, so challenging opportunities ahead of us. Capital investment. Holden needs some heavy maintenance. It's depicted in the sewage system, the water hydro system, or Mother Nature with her acts of an avalanche activity or so on, and you're well on that way. But capital investment is needed, and I know you're soliciting. The Lucerne area has a great future, and it's not lost, and it's there. The tailing piles aren't going to blow away. You do a little bit at a time. There's federal programs looking at it now. There's some fly-by-night programs, and it's going to take some work. The wildfire threat that has been with you ever since you came up here is still there, and maybe getting a little worse with fuel buildup. And I know Al is already alerted, and Sonny and Dick, and we've been talking about pre-planning, hazard reduction, prevention. Those of you that saw the news in Spokane, an urban housing development we lost 25 homes just like that. You're living and telling the wildland resource story, and we hope you can do more of that. We call it multiple use, but it's and Werner has told us the story to us of how you depend on water and 200 cords of wood to heat the place and so on. And I guess the last item, another subtle one, is that you need to sustain the interest of your guests in coming back here year after year. Dick and I and others have seen places like trail lodges in the Columbia Gorge that were built by hand by people. They enjoyed it and brought their children in, and then all of a sudden interest waned, and the people and the resources weren't there, and you need to market and sell and advertise continued to use the pole. Those are the highlights and opportunities. I'm sorry I took too long.
That's all right.
You're still excited.
All right, good. And I can appreciate that.
It's good information.
It was good information, and I hope we folks will be able to come back and discuss a lot more of that. I know that's Smitty's and Bush and their store of knowledge, and I hope we get into that a little bit later. And now, Gary's going to take it and talk about, expose everybody that hasn't been exposed to it, is on how we're going to be moving into the future with forest planning.
Now, this is not specific to Holden, and before I really get into forest plan, I'd like to talk a little bit about the Wenatchee National Forest. Wenatchee National Forest is a very large and complex forest. It's one of seven forests in the state of Washington. And I think you need to know a little bit about it so you can kind of understand what we're doing in the forest plan. The Wenatchee is a big forest, like I said. It's 135 miles long. It goes from north of Lake Chelan to south of Yakima in the Goat Rocks Wilderness. Excuse me for a minute. It's also a long, narrow forest. It's 65 miles wide. It goes from the breaks of the Columbia to the top of the Cascades. Change of elevation from about 500 feet to 10,000 feet. So the terrain is very varied. It's about 2.2 million acres in size. 39% of the forest is in wilderness. This is areas that have been set aside by Congress so that there's no development in the wilderness. There's no timber sales, no use of motorized equipment. It's set aside for to be wilderness, to go in and enjoy and see what the primitive forest is like. 550,000 acres of our forest outside of wilderness is unroaded still. And that leaves about 800,000 acres on the forest that is roaded. This is where the intensive management takes place. Timber sales, the use of motorized vehicles, this type of thing. We have 4,700 miles of road on the forest, 2,550 miles of trails. 1,250 miles of these trails are inside wilderness. The rest of them are outside, of course, of which 950 miles are open to motorized use, motorcycles. And I'd like to come back to that in a few minutes. We sell quite a bit of timber on the forest. We sell about 170 million board feet of timber a year. If we, that's quite a bit. If we, if the average house took about 5,000 board feet of timber, that'd be 34,000 houses. That's a lot of houses. We have very heavy recreation use on the forest. We are probably have somewhere in the area of the sixth or seventh highest recreation use of all national forest in the nation. We're currently being managed by a series of plans that are quite old now. A lot of the plans were prepared in the 60s. They have become outdated, and it's very difficult to give us very good guidance. One of our plans, which is the Alpine Lakes plan, is our latest plan. Our newest plan is a very good plan. It was finalized in 1981, and we are incorporating this plan in our new forest plan without any changes. In 1976, Congress passed a bill, a law, called the National Forest Management Act. And among other things, this act required us for each forest to prepare a forest plan. This forest plan is to document how we plan to manage the forest in the next coming years. Specifically, the plan is to look at the next 10 years and identify how we're going to use the land, what activities are going to take place on the land, and also make projections of what the forest is going to look like in many decades to come. Now, the Wenatchee completed their draft plan last year in June of 1986, and we sent it out to the public for comment, which is required in the process that we follow. We had it out for comment for 90 days. During this period, we visited with a lot of people. We went and held 60 meetings. We met with groups that were very interested in various phases of the management of the forest. And we received lots of comments back from them on our draft plan. We received 4,700 responses, which contained 45,000 comments. These comments will be answered individually. They'll be answered in the final forest plan when we come out. We have read each one of the comments. We're going to respond to it, and we're going to use some of the ideas, and as you know, there's a lot of comments for and against, and some of them we can use and some of them we can't. 94% of the comments came from the state of Washington, so you can see where the interest is. 56% of the comments came from the east side of of Washington, and 38% from the west side. the public input, through the public input process, we identified several major issues that have not been resolved. In other words, the public took a look at our draft plan and said, hey, we don't agree with you, and we'd like to see you do this. And most of the issues, it was people's on both sides, on this extreme and on this extreme. We were someplace in the middle. And I'd like to share those major issues with you. One of them I talked about earlier is we have a lot of trails open to motorized use on the forest. This is a very big issue on the Wenatchee Forest. We have a lot of trails in this category. So one of our major issues is the conflict between trail users, motorized and hikers. Another major issue is the timber harvest level on the forest. As I said before, presently we sell about 170 million board feet. We propose to reduce that somewhere down in the vicinity of 140 to 138 million, which is a pretty sizable reduction. And there's a lot of concern by people that make their living in the woods of this reduction. The economy of the communities is at stake in some areas, and the employment of a lot of the people. Another major issue is the concern for overcutting and intermingled ownership. By intermingled ownership, I'm talking about where we own a section of land and a large lumber company or industry group owns another section of land. They're checkerboard.
Pardon? Close?
I'm getting close. And this is a very much an issue with our public. In other words, they see the private lands being cut at a very rapid pace and causing, as they view it, some watershed problems, some erosion of soils that impact on the fisheries. And they're telling us and asking us to delay our harvest until the private lands recover. This is a major issue because this reduces our timber harvest further. There's also the roadless issue. I mentioned that there's something like 800,000 acres of roadless areas on the Wenatchee Forest at the present time. We proposed in our forest plan, in our draft forest plan, to access and road about half of those acres. Industry thinks that we're not going in nearly enough, and people that want to see more roadless areas think that we're going way too far. Another issue is our old growth forest. We're harvesting more and more of our older trees, old growth forests, or trees that are older than 250 years, 300 years old in that category. And these forests are starting to be depleted, especially outside of wilderness. We do have quite a reserve inside wilderness. So those are some of the major issues. Speaking just real quickly, specific to Holden Village, as our draft forest plan was prepared, it would have very little effect on the management of Holden Village and the area surrounding Holden Village. As you know, Holden Village is surrounded on three sides by wilderness, and there's a narrow corridor that goes down to Lake Chelan, which would be managed in a very for scenic and recreation purposes. So there'd be very little effect of the forest plan directly on the Holden Village complex. Al.
Okay. Well, thank you. I appreciate it from all. And I hope you folks understand that the topics that they're all talking about are very deep subjects, and that we've just, like a flat rock across water, we've just skimmed across the top. If we open it up for questions now, and I think we can get some good debate going, but I would ask that we don't try to resolve any specific problems here. If we try to resolve a problem, we'll get bogged down right away. Is that okay with everybody? That I think we need to have a lot of dialogue and a lot of discussion, but if we don't try to resolve a problem, and if we try to resolve a problem, how about if I step in and throw a piece of paper in the air? That means cool. How's that? Is that okay with everybody? There's got to be a lot of everybody's, all three of them have, four of them, excuse me, brought up a lot of good questions, and let's get some good discussion going.
Any possibility that the mine interest might open up again?
Yeah, let me comment on that. Are you talking specifically the Holden Mine?
Yeah, or the Copper Mine.
The only that portion which is out of wilderness, that's the first thing I want to say. Since 1984, existing wilderness and all new wilderness being made is no longer open to entry. Any legitimate claim within wildernesses at the time of that cutoff could still be exercised if they are kept proven. But so wilderness, no. As far as this mine, who owns it? Who owns it? Holden Village? Then it's up to Holden Village. So that's really the answer to your question.
Well, one thing to follow along with that, might add, is one of the things that we're going to be doing next year is looking at taking a good hard look at these tailings out here and figuring out if there's a good system to manage those and to do something with them.
Are they a problem now in the toxic area? Or I don't know what kind of problem the tailings are.
Who wants to answer?
Well, it's a three-pronged problem. We've done lots of study cooperatively with the village. Spent a lot of money, more money on study than solution, as usual. But it's not a simple problem. And the three-pronged problem are these. And all of you have been here very long have witnessed the dust. All right? You know, that's potentially a health hazard. There's a leachate that exits a mine, and if you've walked up the mine road, you've seen it coming out, you've seen the white rocks, and it has arsenic and heavy metals in it. And so the third, the erosion at the base of the piles by Railroad Creek and the exportation of that material down into Lake Chelan. Lake Chelan might be the best example of that trite comment that the solution to pollution is dilution. In that case, we've got enough lake to do it, but it's not the way it ought to be done. And so, in the meantime, of course, Railroad Creek's a sterile, beautiful mountain stream, but sterile. The solutions then have to deal with the leachate. That's the simplest of all the problems. That can be ponded and heavy metals removed, and probably the least expensive, still expensive. Finding a way to stabilize the top of the piles and eliminate the windborne pollution problem is a big one, because we're dealing with a lot of acres, about 80 acres of surface acres. And then the faces of the pile and armoring the bases. You know, the managers of this unit know, that anything you do up here, about 50% of the costs are the logistics of getting men, equipment here to do anything, or materials. And obviously that's true with the tailings piles. So we're looking at on-site solutions. For example, base of the piles rearmored with cedar cribbing, taken from the natural cedar in the valley. That would be a solution that continues to require maintenance. That's not a very attractive one. Covering the piles with the mill waste, and or the tunnel waste really, and which are in a large pile out there. But they possess some of the same problems. So it is it's a complex, it's a difficult problem. There have been a lot of ideas on how to do it, one of which would have cost us about $25 million. But we're determined to find a way. It's a responsibility we inherited. We would have liked Howe Sound to take care of the problem. It didn't work out that way. So the people of the United States inherited the problem. And we keep looking for a way.
Another one.
On the mining thing, I was reading the hiking guide that the Kennecott claim up by Image Lake is still active. Would the 84 ruling, has that kind of precluded any big pit mining appearing up there?
No. The Kennecott copper claims are patented.
Yeah.
They are held in fee title by the Kennecott company or whoever they would sell it to. The greatest prevention of protection for mining that resource is a concern about the company image and the politics that would flow. And that's been preventative in other cases, rather notorious cases in wilderness. It is a very rich ore body. The company has shown responsibility and they're looking for a low impact on the land way of accomplishing that. But anyone like yourself that's seen the place would recognize that any disturbance would be an impact. But it is another one of the nation's resources, and it is privately owned in the midst of wilderness.
You had mentioned that you hoped the Howe Company might have solved the problem before you took it over or inherited it. how were you thinking that they might have done?
Well, in present time, you know, if we move this forward, the mining law, basic mining laws of the United States haven't changed. And there's a very powerful lobby that, well represented in the Western Senate and the Western Congresses, that prevent modernization of those laws. And some of us sent the up to be modernized. And however, we've been given tools like the National Environmental Policy Act and the Organic Act for the Bureau of Land Management, which give us some tools to control the operations plans of mining. Also, modern mining has a lot of sophistication that didn't exist at that time. They would have probably used some similar decanting process, but they would have had to provide for protecting the movement of leachate and material into a water source.
A sort of example of that is the Cannon mine that's operating right outside of Wenatchee, then, and they went through all these processes and satisfied the public, and it's quite an operation too, a gold mine, and they're using different processes, and they varied it depending on what they found out and so on. So that is not being looked upon as a huge impact yet.
Rudy could tell us that better than I, much better than I, that the company did envision putting that material, is, most of you know, some of you may not, came out as a slurry mixture of water and material and was put in the settling ponds, as it were, and it built up what you see there today as the water evaporated and was decanted off. But they envisioned returning it to the mine, and they put a portion of it back.
Yeah.
And they just ran out of time and money. That would not have solved the problem, however, because the leachate that's coming out of the mine is the material they put in, mixing with groundwater, which is exiting. But it still would have been much simpler to solve, because that had been the only one of the three-pronged problems I discussed we'd be dealing with, and we could have managed that long ago, economically.
What else? Yeah, there has been. In fact, there's some active questions on there right now. To the best of my knowledge, I believe there's supposedly about 15,000 tons of gold in those 90 million tons.
Don't everybody leave now, don't
yeah. It's out there. It's not in a free form. In the last study done in about, I believe it was about 1982, it would cost about $11.75. No, excuse me, the value was about $11.75 in Puget Sound area for that material, and a cost of getting it there of about $15 a ton, which is an $18 million deficit. So it's not a real economic operation right now. How about something else other than the mine tailings? How about the general management of the forest?
Yeah, about a week ago, my wife and I were hiking up in the Mount Jefferson area in Oregon, which is an extremely beautiful area and easy to get to, too easy to get to, and it's very fragile. And it's obvious that people aren't going to be able to keep going in there, and the volumes and increases that are happening now. Are we going to have to limit the people in there, and when and how might that happen?
I think Bush is a real good one to answer that question for. He's quite familiar with that area.
I guess it's better, but I'm also responsible for wilderness management in the region. And we held a formal review, which is a quality assurance approach the Forest Service uses in all resource management, and on wilderness, on the forest that manages the Mount Jeff, along with parts of the Three Sisters and several other wildernesses, the Willamette National Forest. We held that review a year ago. And our findings and action plan achieved through the forest indicated exactly what you say, that Mount Jefferson Wilderness is not receiving an appropriate level of management. That's the most candid way I can say it. And we will approach that and every other case like that in the following steps. Our philosophy, and it's back to this serving the land or caring for the land and serving people, is to use a light on the people regulation approach. just as we try to get people to use a light on the land use approach in your camping, backpacking, and so on. We do not want to solve the wilderness problems that we all face collectively with regulation. We will retreat to that when it's the only course available to us, and we have done that on this forest and only on this forest in our region, in Oregon and Washington, where you now are required to get a permit in advance, and there is a limited availability to the match to the carrying capacity of the wilderness in the case of the enchantments outside of Leavenworth. Will we go to that route on the Mount Jefferson? We'll pursue these steps first. And the first one is education. And education's working, you know, and that's a quick one to throw up to, well, solve all of the ills of society with additional education. But in fact, it's working. I've got, as I said, 30 years experience, and some of that's returning to the same places. And I've seen country repair itself when the users of the country develop an ethic, when they care, when they use modern equipment, and we don't teach little Boy Scouts to go out and chop trees and make beds out of them anymore. We tell them to go down to REI and buy an air mattress. And so we've come a long way in learning together to develop a social ethic toward our wilderness. That's the only ultimate prevention is, or protection as far as I'm concerned. We'll do that. We will then go to some recommended practices, such as don't camp within 200 feet of a stream, many other things. When that doesn't solve the problem, we will go then to regulated practices rather than regulated entry, such as close the Jeff Park area if that became essential, or Marion Lake. There are other off-site tools to use to forestall that eventuality, one of which is to withdraw the convenience of the roads and the trailheads. Now, when it's I-90 going through Snoqualmie Pass, it's about 2 minutes walk to the wilderness boundary, and I really don't think the highway department would be pleased if we closed I-90. So we don't have too many places that, or we have some places where that doesn't work, but many, many of the road systems are just, you know, like this one here. They are under our control. So withdrawing convenience of access is an off-wilderness tool. But it's very easy to ruin the wilderness experience for yourself and people like you by having to deal with so many bureaucratic rules when in fact the whole system was created so that you've got a right to die out there, which is really the easiest way for me to say it, and I really mean that honestly, that you have a right to encounter nature on nature's terms and deal with your own skill level and your own knowledge and the challenge that you experience when you do that, and not have some bureaucrat sitting on a rock take care of you. And you know, I will fight to the death for your right to die out there, and my right to die out there. Also my right to have a really good time out there. And so, and incidentally, I'm not an agnostic. I know I was publicly exposed for not being a pastor.
Okay. No excuses at this point. I see we have another question back
here.
Well,
this is an attack because I think you were all in the wrong church. I was conversing for 20 minutes with a four-point buck and his harem, too, and his children from 6 feet away. And I think the ultimate church is the wilderness. And it is for me. And so we will take as light a hand on regulation as we can take, but we have work to do, all of us, together at Mount Jefferson and places like this.
Mm-hmm. Now, I appreciate your point. I come from California, and Southern California in particular is a completely different situation. There are so many people, and if the state of Washington gets so many people, eventually you're going to have to face the same thing. We work with these regulations, all of which you have just mentioned, and most of us who are very much in favor of limitation are very willing to have to work within that system. It'd be nice to be able to just walk into the wilderness with no restrictions, but you have to work for permits, various limitations, and there's any number of places that are actually closed down to, in fact, even walking through, not to say anything about camping yet. And you're aware of that being
certainly
in the service. I think majority of people in this room don't appreciate, in fact, this already happened a lot of the places, or some of the places at least in this country.
Yeah.
In the Wenatchee Forest survey that you had conducted, did you get negative reactions to Holden Village presence here?
I don't think we got any reaction at all. I think that no adverse action whatsoever.
Okay.
I don't think we heard much from Holden Village either.
No.
So you didn't hear much either positive or negative?
That's right. That's right.
I think it's important to hear positive things as well as negative things. A lot of times we get, when we do things right, we quite often don't hear about that. And those that hear, or that we do hear from, perhaps get a little more ear as a result of silent majority is not really a good way to manage. Usually when people say nothing, that means they disagree with you. Because if they agreed with you, sure, they'd be sitting there, yeah, sure, and make some statement. So I have a feeling there's a lot of people in here who don't agree with us.
Come on, back there.
All right, go ahead.
I'm really curious on any changes in timber harvesting practices that might be anticipated in your new plan. Any alternatives to clear cutting, such as selective harvesting of old timber in order to not have to go through the 30-year cycle of regrowth? Are there any changes anticipated?
Well, of course, we use many different silviculture prescriptions on the forest right now. Clear cutting just happens to be one that we use where it's absolutely necessary. And looking at the future, we anticipate that the approximately the same proportion of clear cutting to other silviculture methods will be used in the future. So there will be definitely be clear cutting. I think we are getting better each year at how we use clear cutting and how it looks. I just reviewed a timber sale this last week on one of our districts that had some small clear-cut units in, had some shelterwood where we leave a lot of trees left in the units, and it's just a very well-done project, and I think that it's in a very highly visible recreation area, and I doubt if very many people in this room would notice it unless they were attuned to that type of thing.
What are the reforestation requirements for people who do clear-cut?
I'd like to follow up a little bit on what you're getting at. Is every stand that is harvested in the National Forest System receives a specific prescription. It's like if you go to the doctor and you tell him you got a bellyache, hopefully if he's a good doctor, he's going to do a whole lot of questions, ask you a lot of questions.
Toenails.
What's that?
He won't fix your toenails.
Yeah, he won't fix your toenails, but there's a lot of things that can cause a bellyache, and if he's a good doctor, he'll try to figure out what the specific cause is and then recommend a specific treatment for that. And that same analogy is true with all stands of timber. Some species grow better and generate, in fact, they have to have sunlight to grow through their younger years, which probably most everybody knows. So specific prescriptions are written for each and every individual stand. When we sell a stand of timber, we do a long-range plan for it to bring it back up to a rotation age, the next generation. So we collect enough money on that sale that comes out of the receipts of the timber sales to go in, reforest that area, care for it, for establishment, thin it, and bring it along to the next stage.
It answers, excuse
me. You go ahead and go answer ahead. The five-year thing.
Yeah. To answer your question specifically, before we can cut any trees, harvest any timber sale units, that we have to be assured that we can replant, regenerate that site within 5 years. And that's also one of the provisions in the National Forest Management Act that I mentioned earlier.
You had a question over here.
I live in the Midwest, and that's kind of amazed. Most of the trails out here are different. There's more trails to start with. Our trails are a lot wetter. Yours are very dry. Our trails break down fast because of water. Most of our trails where they hit a soft spot or are not good hard ground are wooded. I mean, there's long expanses of wooded area, and it does break up somewhat from hiking in a wilderness area. On the other hand, the trail isn't washed away, and your feet don't get wet either. You know, and that's not all bad. I don't know about when hiking here. There's a lot of areas where people have made water runs from the mountainside, just like, well, why aren't those wooded? I don't know if there's too much here, or, and why haven't they been?
Why haven't we treated them to where you see the erosion coming down? Is that what you're talking about?
And, you know, why haven't some way, like our trails where they're eroding, where there's a wood boardwalk over them, and it's a hassle, and it's a hassle to keep them up, but they're very worthwhile because then the woods around you isn't destroyed.
Bush and I were just talking about that today.
Let me deal with that. Just by a wonderful coincidence, I'm on the side of wilderness and cultural resources and recreation. I'm also responsible for trails. I took a hike today that really addresses your problem specifically, and I suspect it's an area you've hiked in because it's the access up the valley. Within a quarter mile, half mile of the time you enter the wilderness, you enter an area, a very short stretch you're talking about. And for any of you that have walked up there, it's a nice walk, but now you'll have something to look at besides just the forest. And you can take a look at this for yourself, because in a very short stretch of a few hundred feet, there are examples of three ways to deal with water in trail tread. And the first step you always take is to dewater. And if you can successfully do that, then you don't need what we call puncheon or you call boardwalk. So you dewater. You'll see an example in this little site I'm talking about up there. But you'll also see another technique, and you hit it first, and it's the longest stretch. What you will see visibly, it's only your casual eye, is you'll see the trench that was dewatered, which is all and is all vegetated now by natural plants. You'll see two log stringers along the edge of the trail. What you won't see is an understructure, which is treated lumber, and which is supporting a imported material of soil and rock that has the bearing strength to be a trail. The native material in that particular area has the bearing strength to make a horse disappear. And it was doing that. And so that material, that piece was done, and I want you to listen up. It was done by a volunteer Sierra Club party with members from the banking community in New York, a woman from Pennsylvania, et cetera, that sign up through the Sierra Club for national work parties. They've also worked on the other side of the lake in the Sawtooth in rehabilitating and removing trails that were in an illogical and improper location. And we're going to get to that as the next solution to the problem, not building a boardwalk. So you try to dewater, and you try to build, because we're talking there wilderness, but I think anywhere, you're trying to build something that is substantially unnoticeable as the work of man. Now that's a direct quote out of the description, wilderness in the act. But you see, I think that's good advice anywhere. I don't like to walk a trail that appears to me to have been highly manufactured for my use. I'd rather think I was on a mountain trace. And so substantially unnoticeable and still functional is a goal. When you leave that stretch I'm talking about, the next little piece you'll get covering moving water is a little boardwalk, if you like. Sawed timbers with two kick rails on the side. Pretty subtle, but inappropriate, entirely inappropriate in wilderness. That would not be built a bit. We would have continued the other. It was functioning, so we didn't pull it out. Just beyond that, you have true puncheon, and that is logs laid on a edge log running the length of the trail, log set on top and pinned in, and it's been there for a long, long time, operated successfully. So in that short stretch of trail, just a half mile up there, you can get yourself a little course in trail construction. But ultimately, the real key is location. Most of these trails in the National Forest System were built by stockmen that were taking sheep and cattle into the country, miners that were seeking and developing ore bodies, Forest Service that was heading for remote lookouts and fire access. They were built for functional access, for relatively low use. And so bearing strength of those trails was not a big important element. Neither was the experience of the person that traveled. Today, we look at trails as linear recreation facilities, a place for you to enjoy nature. We are not slightly interested in getting to the objective of the trail in the shortest distance. The longest may be the best. We are interested in trails of many, many different difficulties. And so many of our, much of our trail system in the United States and certainly in the Northwest needs relocation. In wilderness, we will build very, very few new access trails. The other thing that's happening is people are learning to avoid each other, which is one way you get a higher social carrying capacity in wilderness. I'm an avoider. My wilderness experience is the ultimate when I see no one. And that is for my wife and I, and sometimes I think that hers would be no one, period. So the avoiders, in this, those of you, and there's several of you in this room that have developed lots of skills to go cross country, to test your mettle, to test your knowledge and your skill and your self-dependence. We are not going to trail wilderness and make it convenient for you beyond the trail systems are there. We're going to remove some, and we're going to put some in the right place. And so that's really the trail program in the West, and we're going to try to do it with as few of facilities that you can see as possible. And with the absolute minimum trace, this trail up the bottom to me is freeway. And we will use techniques to narrow that, to get vegetated material back to shrink the visible tread there, because the ultimate tread is about boot width to me. So that's the program in trails.
We got a question up here.
Yeah, perhaps you answered my question, but I'm curious. You go up toward Lyman Lake, you go past Rebel Campground, of course it's all closing in, and that's all very well and good. But heading up to Holden Lake, it's doing that same thing. Mm-hmm. And there are sections where it's extremely steep, and if you miss the trail, you could roll for a few hundred feet or something. In that situation, are you planning to do some trimming just to make it a little more?
If we intend to keep the trail, then the level of maintenance we will give it will deal with the question you very properly put, public safety. All right, when it's cross-country travel, public safety is personal safety. It's your obligation. When it's a facility that we provide and continue to provide, a trail, even if it's in the wrong place again, we'd relocate it. But if we intend that trail for use, then the maintenance level we give it must deal with safety. Okay. So, yes. And you're probably talking where Tag Alder's coming out and it's pushing you to the limit of the trail.
Right, exactly.
And if Tag Alder is commingled with the trail, it's probably in the wrong place.
Mm-hmm.
Tag Alder is a very unfriendly creature out there. Even that little deer, that's one reason I was talking to its dad, is because he was really clumsy. And I thought I should give him some parenting advice, because I've been staying with Anna and John Shelley up there, and so I've learned a little. And so I tried to share that with the dad, because Mama obviously neglected her duties.
I don't think you were one to give advice.
No, he didn't take it. So.
Another question up here.
How about firefighting in the wilderness area?
Glad you asked that.
He's also in charge of fire control.
reason I'm glad is I just rode through, and these people in the Wenatchee,
he's not in charge of fire control,
but they would never take any credit for this. But I just rode for 5 days on horseback through the North Fork John Bay Wilderness. And many of you know that Northeast Oregon was visited by a lot of lightning fire last year, and some very large ones. I rode through two that were in about 5,000 to 7,000 acre class that burned through an area that was devastated by, I don't like that term, that was eaten by insects, which is a very natural thing for some insects to do to trees. And it's not really devastation, certainly not from the insect standpoint. And so a lot of dead trees out there. And we expected very abnormal fire behavior, but we are also moving toward a very light on the land wilderness ethic to begin to return fire to its natural occurrence in wilderness, because it's a part of that natural system. And when we have been very successful in fire prevention and control over the years, and we built some big problems as a result, those fires were marvelous to visit. And I rode 2.5 miles along a fire line on horseback, and I've, in my 30 years, seen quite a few fires, made lots of fire trail, and left a lot of scars on the land. And it took a very, very trained eye to see the fire suppression activity that took place just 1 year ago. and I say that's a marvelous success. That fire did not exit Wilderness. The fire plans were set that if it did, it would have been stopped. The tools were available to do that. Two Wenatchee overhead crews manned the two fires that I'm talking about. This particular forest has a long history of a very high level of expertise in fire because we got lots of opportunity to practice. And we use Forest Service people all over the United States, as you may know, that are highly skilled on what we now call incident command teams. And two of those teams from this forest did the job in the John Day Wilderness, and it's marvelous to see. Because just like Mount St. Helens, you're seeing nature come right back, and that tremendous resurgence and vitality that's in the natural world is evident to you there. And the elk are extremely happy with that fire, and so are the mushroom hunters.
Let me add a little bit more. I'll be a little bit briefer. We have two types of fires in the Forest Service. We have a prescribed fire, and we have wildfire. If a fire starts, we have an obligation to take a suppression action on the fire. Okay, we have three options. We go in and contain it, confine it, or control it. And control would be we get in there and stop it from going in, getting any bigger, and that's the appropriate action. On some other operations, if they're higher up, we can confine them to a certain area and a containment, which is another strategy. But we do not allow fires a let-burn policy. There is no let-burn policy in the Forest Service whatsoever. Those fires that are considered to be a prescribed fire, now in some areas they may be started by lightning, or they may be started by us. And there, they are intended to reach specific objectives that are established before the fire starts. We can't go in and have a fire start and then go say that this is a good deal. In the wilderness area, we don't have prescribed fires that benefit wildlife or benefit watershed or critters or anything else. They would be allowed to burn only if they benefit the wilderness management of that area.